From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, the latest fight over abortion rights plays out in a Texas courtroom.
Their argument, the government said, was this is not about politics. This is about science and whether or not a medication is safe.
Uvalde moms, four women united through a deadly tragedy.
It's a club. Unfortunately, it's not a club anybody wants to be a part of, but it's our club now, and we work with what we have.
And March Madness, what is America's fascination with college basketball's biggest tournament?
Just the feeling of you don't know what's going to happen. It's sort of this unscripted drama that's unfolding in front of you in real time.
All ahead on Perspective. Since the collapse of Silicon Valley and then Signature Banks last week, it has been a tumultuous week in the banking industry. Late in the week, we learned that several of the biggest banks in the country came to the rescue of another facility in trouble, First Republic. That is, Silicon Valley Bank began bankruptcy proceedings, and the Department of Justice and SEC began investigations into all of it. To help us unpack all of it, our Elizabeth Schulze joins us. She covers all things business for us here at ABC News. Elizabeth, a couple of weeks ago, we were all worrying about inflation, maybe jobs. Now, all of a sudden, we're looking at the banking system and saying, now this? What's driving all this?
Right. And to be clear, Sherry, inflation is still a big concern right now. But what has happened in such a short time span is that we saw two pretty classic bank runs. This Silicon Valley Bank came out last week, said that it was having trouble making its expenses, to simplify, and it was having a hard time raising enough cash. That freaks out investors. That freaks out people who have money in Silicon Valley Bank, and they all rush to try to take it out at the same time. That's kind of a textbook run where then the bank can't meet all of those demands at the same time, and it's forced to get taken over by the government. And really, at a very fast pace, we saw the government take over Silicon Valley Bank. Within 2 days, the government said that it had also taken over another bank called Signature Bank. And there was really this extraordinary effort from the federal government to say that it was going to protect the depositors of those banks, saying that it was going to guarantee that even if you had more than that $250,000 insured limit, you're still going to be able to get those deposits back. And really, that was an effort to try to protect startups, small businesses who had put all their money in this bank, or a lot of it, and were worried about making payroll, were worried about day-to-day costs. In the span of a couple days, we saw there were concerns about other banks. Credit Suisse was one of them, also potentially didn't have enough cash. So there is a nervousness in the banking sector right now. The underlying picture here is that banks are facing higher interest rates. That weighs on their bottom line. And there are concerns in the stock market that some other banks might also struggle moving forward. And that's why we're seeing this kind of nervousness overall right now. And we're seeing this major effort from the federal government to step into.
How much of this is being driven by fear?
Fear is a big part of this. The banking system is very much based on trust, and we saw that trust waver a little bit over the past week. And people's memories are pretty fresh still. They think about the 2008 financial crisis when we saw this cascade of bank failures. That was something people want to avoid. At the end of the day, the message from regulators is the overall system is sound, that these banks that are coming out with concerns are more isolated incidents. But they're still going to say that we're going to take these steps to protect you if we need to, because they don't want this to spread more into the broader banking system.
What should people keep an eye out for in the future going forward when they want to keep their make sure their money's safe?
Okay, so here's the most important thing right now is that your money in the bank is safe. That is the message, at least, that we are hearing resoundingly from the Treasury Secretary that has said we're going to take whatever steps are needed to protect Americans' deposits. If you have more than $250,000 in the bank, that amount is insured. You might want to consider making sure that if you have more than that, you have your money in different banks. It's never a good idea to have all of your money stored up in one place. So it could be worth looking at your investments and saying, should we spread this out broader if you are one of those people? The other thing to keep in mind is that the stock market is choppy. So if you are a short-term investor, you can be looking at these moves in the stock market and get a little bit nervous. But generally, most people out there are investing for the long run. And it's important to keep that in mind to try to weather through some of this uncertainty when you're looking at kind of the impact on your portfolio in the longer term, Sherry.
So kind of stay the course and just relax for a little bit. ABC's Elizabeth Schulze, your business correspondent here at ABC News. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thanks so much, Sherry.
It's been 9 months since the Supreme Court's ruling overturning a woman's constitutional right to an abortion, but the debate over the procedure continues. As we record this week's program, activists on both sides of the abortion debate are waiting for a ruling in a case that could threaten the country's most common method for ending pregnancies. Trump-appointed federal judge Matthew Kaczmarek says he will rule as soon as possible after hearing 4 hours of debate over a Christian group's request to revoke or suspend the FDA's approval of the drug mifepristone. Joining us now is our senior national policy reporter, Ann Flaherty. And on the one side, you've got anti-abortion activists arguing that mifepristone is unsafe and should be banned. On the other, you've got abortion rights supporters saying, come on, this drug has been on the market for more than 2 decades. It would be highly unusual for a judge to question the FDA's approval process for something like this. Was that the gist of the arguments we heard in court?
So you've got the two sides laying out their arguments. One side says the pill is dangerous and that the FDA fast-tracked the drug's approval for political reasons. That's something both the FDA and the medical community say just simply isn't true. They say the pill is safer than most drugs in America's medicine cabinets and that these 23 years that mifepristone has been on the market, there have been no safety concerns.
How many women have terminated pregnancies with this drug? And it is the most common way that a pregnancy is terminated, isn't it?
More than half of all of abortions rely on this abortion medication. That's according to the CDC and to the Guttmacher Institute. They say this is a very common method of abortion. And the reason being is that it's private. It's something that you can take in the privacy of your own home, and you don't have to cross that picket line to get into a clinic. So surgical abortions are still common, but this has become an increasingly popular method since it hit the market in the year 2000. So it's also very popular online. Sites are offering this for sale outside the scope of the FDA. The FDA warns people not to buy these pills online, but there are pill brokers that are buying this medication up from overseas pharmacies, and then they're providing it to women, mailing it to their homes, even in states where it's illegal. So these pills have become ubiquitous. This is where the fight on abortion rights has landed. It's on this medication abortion. It's no longer with these clinics.
And I've got one more question. Really, why didn't the people who are challenging this go against, say, how people get this? For instance, online, they order it from these pill brokers instead of going after the FDA approval process. Wouldn't they have had a better chance if they had gone with how people are getting this drug?
So, you know, I've talked to the lawyers of the plaintiffs on this, and they say that they want to go after every possible way that women are getting access to this medication. I think this was the low-hanging fruit, that they find a judge who he has a track record of opposing abortion rights. He's a single judge in Amarillo, Texas. They can file the court case there. And then it goes to the Fifth Circuit. If it gets appealed, it goes to another court that's known for its conservative bent. We think this will eventually land in the Supreme Court. And I think for them, it sends a signal that they want the country to say, this is not okay. We want this pill off the market. But yes, you're still going to have this practical reality on the ground, which is that if a woman wants to get an abortion, she's going to find the means to do that, and she's probably going to be accommodated by these overseas businessmen.
ABC Senior National Policy Reporter Ann Flaherty. Coming up, guns in America. President Biden signs an executive order on background checks. What does it mean, and will it change anything in the debate over gun rights? On Perspective after this.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Perspective. I'm Sherry Preston. This week, President Biden traveled to Monterey Park, California, the predominantly Asian American community outside Los Angeles, where a gunman opened fire inside of a dance hall in January while people were celebrating the Lunar New Year. 11 were killed. The president made the stop to meet with the families of the victims, but also to announce a new executive order on gun control. ABC's Alex Stone was in Monterey Park for the announcement and tells us, depending on who you talk to, the executive order will either vastly change how guns are sold or won't do anything at all.
With heavy rain falling, President Biden's motorcade drove through this city torn apart by a mass shooting. Now, nearly 2 months later, investigators still don't know why a 72-year-old opened fire. The president spent time with the victims and their families at a Boys and Girls Club, naming each person who was killed here.
Nigal, 72. Mr. Nice.
The list went on and on.
Nancy Jian, 62. Known as Sister Sunshine.
Well, the president was here to console the families.
Let you know you are loved and not alone.
He was also here to sign an executive order, one the White House says will expand background checks for gun sales.
It'll accelerate and intensify this work to save more lives more quickly.
But the president's powers are limited when it comes to guns. He cannot expand background check laws. That is up to Congress. So his executive order instructs his administration to enforce laws that are already in place, but maybe aren't always being followed, and tells the attorney general to look at whether more categories of gun sales could require background checks under current law.
To move us as close as we can to universal background checks without new legislation.
His executive order also instructs the FTC to study whether gun makers are marketing toward children, to do more public awareness campaigns about red flag laws, and to promote safe storage of guns. But it's Congress who would have to change law.
As I continue to call on Congress to require background checks for all firearm sales.
There are dramatically different takes on the executive order. Groups supporting tighter gun control, like Every Town for Gun Safety, say the executive order will have a major impact. Nick Suplina is Every Town's Senior Vice President of Law and Safety.
What we heard from the president was a huge win for public safety. Its focus on expanding background checks on gun sales as much as possible will keep weapons out of dangerous hands and save lives.
But Katie Pointer-Bainey, Managing Director of Government Affairs for the U.S. Concealed Carry Association, says the executive order won't stop violent crime at all.
This is, in reality, not going to have an impact on the mass shootings, the unfortunate tragedies that we've seen.
She argues going after guns won't change anything, but instead she says the focus needs to be on societal problems like poverty, domestic abuse, and opioid addiction.
It seems that the White House is more focused on the appearance of doing something to stop crime versus actually taking concrete steps to make our community safer.
But Nick Suplina at Every Town says the executive order does have teeth and that the focus will be on getting it fully implemented.
Well, you know, what we often hear from gun extremists is, hey, just enforce the laws that are on the books. And that's precisely what the president is doing here, telling his agencies to enforce the laws on the books, to implement them fully.
The president's desire for universal background checks is a focus for Every Town.
There's no question that a foundational law in a country that has so many guns in private hands is comprehensive background checks on all gun sales.
Katie Pointer-Bainey over the Concealed Carry Association says they're not against background checks. In fact, they support them for legal purchases, but they are against new gun laws.
We are enforcing the laws currently on the books that we don't need new gun laws. That's not going to stop future tragedies from happening because we know by definition criminals don't follow the law. Instead, let's make investments and take concrete steps that actually are going to make our community safer.
Reporting for Perspective, I'm Alex Stone, ABC News in Monterey Park, California.
The debate over gun rights was raging long before a gunman opened fire at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas last May, killing 19 fourth graders and two of their teachers. For many of those affected by the tragedy in that community, the fight over gun rights is far less important than the loss of loved ones. Out of the Uvalde tragedy, four women forged an unbreakable bond. They've opened up to us about their heartbreak and their friendship. Here's ABC's Maria Elena Salinas.
How would you describe this relationship that you have?
A rare moment of laughter between a new group of friends.
I think it's a beautiful relationship, of course, and it's bittersweet because I wish we would have had this relationship before May 24th. But I don't know how I would be getting through any of these days without them.
A relationship born from unimaginable tragedy. Their daughters were all killed at Robb Elementary in Uvalde, Texas last May. As they work through their collective grief, they find comfort in each other.
Because there's a lot of times that we feel alone. You know, even if there's 100 people in the room, you still feel alone. But I don't feel that when I'm with them.
For the first time, these moms are talking to ABC News about their bond.
I have to say I was really looking forward to this point of the day.
And on days when it feels like there is little to look forward to, they find strength in moments like these.
Yes. And she just looks at peace. She's just like, I'm waiting for you, Mom.
We visited their daughter's murals that were painted by Texas artists around the town square shortly after the tragedy. Picking up on a friendship their daughter started, a connection they say their girls knew they needed. Veronica Mata's daughter, Tess, loved to play softball. Ana Rodriguez's daughter, Maite,
I actually took this picture of her,
wanted to be a marine biologist. Kimberly Rubio's daughter, Lexi, dreamed of being a lawyer. And Gloria Cáceres' daughter, Jackie, wanted to visit Paris when she graduated high school.
The I love you to the moon back, that's just what we've always said.
I love the murals. Yeah, the murals really are my favorite part. If I have to go somewhere, it's the murals because there's a little bit of joy, right? It's just, they're beautiful.
In each other, they say they found a deep understanding.
Is there a word that you would describe this type of a relationship?
I think it's a club.
A club?
It's a club. Unfortunately, it's not a club anybody wants to be a part of, but it's our club now, and we work with what we have, so.
Do you ever feel like you feel more comfortable talking to them than even your own family?
Oh, definitely. Outside my husband and my children, these are the only people I talk to about this.
How about the rest of you?
My family is completely understanding, and they've supported me 100%. However, they have not lost a child. Because I know I've had Kim message me out of the blue, thinking of you, I love you, and she has no idea how much that helped me.
Finding someone who understands is not easy. And while some of the moms have started therapy, an analysis by the CDC shows that Latinos are less likely to seek help. 19 of the 21 victims here were Mexican-American.
You know, sometimes from the outside, we have this desire to tell someone who's going through what you've gone through, I feel your pain. But then, can anybody feel your pain other than you?
You don't want somebody to fix it for you. You just want someone to listen. If you were to speak to a family member, they want to fix it for you. Mm-hmm. And you can't fix this. So I think that is where I reach to y'all, because I just want to be heard, and I just want someone who understands. Mm-hmm. Only these women understand.
It's like an unspoken connection.
I feel that connection with them because of the girls, and I feel like if I don't talk to them, like I'm missing a part of Tess, I guess.
Not one more! Not one more!
They spend countless hours together, demanding justice for their daughters. It's here that they've also met other members of that growing club, families of victims from other shootings around the country.
Looking at our future, and which has always been very jarring for me, because you realize in that moment that it never gets better, because these women are still so broken, and it could be 10, 20 years later.
And they don't lie to you either, you know, I say it myself, I just met, or I just saw one this past weekend, and she's like, I'm not gonna lie. She's like, it's not gonna get better. She's like, it's gonna get harder.
As the days pass, they say they also learn to trust each other.
I know that I can say and I can be myself around them, and it's okay. It's okay, we're not getting judged if we're smiling, if we're laughing. It's okay. Mm-hmm. It's okay with them.
When we're in the outside world, you feel judged, you feel guilty. No, we feel guilty already for everything that we do.
You said you already feel guilty, why?
She's not here, our kids aren't here. They don't get to enjoy what they used to enjoy.
So when you say you feel guilty, that's where I feel guilty. How am I laughing so hard at something? Or I'm happy and she's not here, but I'm happy in this moment, I'm happy.
It's like the new happy.
Yeah.
So right? Yeah. So we're never happy again.
Yeah.
This
it's
new
just like
happy.
This new kind of happy.
This is the new happy.
While their lives are forever changed, these moms are grateful that they found each other.
Where do you see your relationship going forward?
It's going to be a lifelong relationship that we're always going to have because we all have that one common denominator.
Mm-hmm. I sometimes like to think that it's the relationship our children would have had.
Yeah. As we sit here, I think Lexi's there, Jackie's here, Tess here, Micah's here. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just a weird thought, but it's one of those weird thoughts that I hope you guys understand. Yes.
ABC's Maria Elena Salinas in Uvalde, Texas. Coming up, the post-COVID era, but not for everybody, on Perspective after this.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, some businesses are experimenting with the four-day work week. Now some schools are doing the same thing. But first, it's been 3 years since the World Health Organization officially declared COVID-19 a pandemic. In that time, more than 1 million Americans have died, and about 1,800 Americans are dying every week from the virus, according to the CDC. But since the development of vaccines and immunity from prior infections, most Americans have moved on. Vaccine and mask mandates are pretty much over. But for those who remain at high risk, watching so many of us drop precautions has been frustrating and scary. Stephanie Tate is a disability advocate who herself is immunocompromised and hasn't been able to simply move on. What's life like for her? She spoke to my colleague, ABC's Brad Milkey, on our daily podcast, Start Here.
Stephanie, what has this pandemic been like for you?
Whew, what a loaded, giant question. So in the beginning, the pandemic was the sensation of seeing the freight train coming and like desperately trying to tell people around me to stop making a joke of the whole thing and waiting to see if anybody would ever care. And then there was this wave of relief when we saw, you know, folks like Tom Hanks got COVID and all of a sudden everybody was like, oh, this is a thing. And suddenly it was, we're all in this together. You know, we're going to focus on vaccines. We're going to take the precautions. We're going to do the things we need to do. And yet the longer this pandemic went on, the more we went through various versions of the same cycle. We would do a bad wave or a bad variant. It would be really bad. And then right after it, all of a sudden, it would be maybe we can relax this. Maybe it wasn't as bad as we're remembering it. And suddenly I was right back to day one, right? Except now there isn't even a cycle anymore. It seems like the majority of people have just gone back to 2019 of there's this freight train coming. We don't see it. We don't care. For the first time, I feel just sort of completely alone in it. I don't expect another wave of we're all in this together to ever really come again.
Do you feel like you're more at risk than the average person?
In my case, I have a pre-existing heart condition. I also had a pre-existing kidney issue, and I take a medication for my arthritis, which makes me immune deficient. So it's sort of a combination of the perfect storm of this is not something I can afford to get in terms of acute infection. But the bigger problem for me is really the long-term risks. So A, I don't want to make it worse, but more than that, B, I don't want this life for my kids.
It's interesting to me that you said you feel like people are living in 2019 and not 2023. Like that, because I hear people describe the post-COVID world. Post-COVID, we're doing this. You almost sound like people are living their pre-COVID lives in a world where COVID is still circulating.
Well, because they are. Like, by what metric are we post-COVID, right? I mean, even the CDC's count, which by all estimates, any expert you ask will tell you it's an undercount because we're not including home tests. People don't test anymore. You don't test, you don't see it. But even by their official counts, we're still losing, what was last week? They said 1,800 people. Just last week, 1,800 COVID deaths were added for the week. And that's just the official ones. So by what metric is it over? Because that doesn't sound over to me at all. So it's not really possible to be living in 2023 as much as you have to be living in 2019. You have to be living in a world where COVID never existed in the first place. Anything else is just, it's denial of reality.
Well, and so to many people at this point of the pandemic, there's risk and reward here, right? The risk is I get COVID. Maybe it's bad. Maybe it's not. The reward, though, is I get to live my life the way I want to live. Like I get to go to an indoor restaurant again. If everyone's risks aren't the same, if someone hasn't had Lyme disease or isn't on chemo who can't risk a flu, public places have never been safe spaces for all these people, right? So why isn't this the same thing as it used to be? You do your thing, I'll do mine.
Yes, it was never fully safe for immunocompromised people in a lot of spaces. And one of the hopes I had in those early periods of COVID that I described was maybe we are finally going to rethink some things. Like, why haven't we been masking in hospitals? That kind of just seems like a no-brainer. Obviously, we'll keep that. But we didn't. It all went away. So yes, you're right. To an extent, it was never fully safe. And I thought we might have a chance to fix it, but we kind of just jumped over it. But the second part of it that I think people are missing is that the reason I say you're living like it's 2019 is because in 2019, COVID, as we know it right now, SARS-2 did not exist. And in order
like that's
to
fundamentally
say,
different from the flu or something.
Yeah. In order to say it's all the same, you have to think that getting SARS-2 is literally the same as getting the flu or cold. And the statistics show it's just not. It's far deadlier.
What kind of reactions do you get from people when you press them, essentially, like, please don't move on?
For the most part, whether on or offline, it really doesn't matter. It's worse on Twitter, but it's both now. We've reached a point where people are not shy about labeling all of this as mental illness, right? At this point, if you care about COVID, if you're trying to prevent infection, you have an anxiety problem.
Like people accuse you of having a mental illness because you're saying, I don't want to get COVID.
Yes. Heck, now we have Eric Adams in New York saying people who mask when they come into stores might be criminals. So you should be suspicious of them. Like it's gotten more and more overt and pushed it to the point where it just empowers people to think there's something wrong with someone who's still masking at this point. For those of us that are high risk, we're being told in no uncertain terms every single day that our lives don't really matter. That you know, when death numbers got high initially, it was, yeah, but those are old people or those are people with pre-existing conditions, right? Like, I'm sorry, it's great news that only people like me are dying. Yeah, that's going to affect your mental health to every day look at the people around you and consistently see this dehumanizing message that your life, your ability to exist and survive this pandemic is honestly worth less to me than eating dinner in an Applebee's.
But so then the question is, what do you think should be done? If you think nobody's going to convince themselves to do anything, are there action items at this point where you're like, this should be done? Or is it just kind of like, I guess I'm other for the rest of my life?
I mean, that's the tough dichotomy. Every single day, right? What we don't want to do is be exactly what everyone claims people like me are, and that's a doomer, right? And the irony when people call people like me a doomer is that it's those of us that are still pushing for things like masks, that are pushing for things like better research on upper UVC and other forms of air filtration and how to better improve our ventilation so that masks are less necessary down the road, right? People that are pushing steps like that are the opposite of doomers. We're the ones that have some kind of hope for a future. If anything, to me, living like you're in 2019, that's doomerism. That's accepting there is no hope. It's all just going to be like this forever. So who cares? Throw in the towel. And I'm just not here for it.
ABC's Brad Milkey with Stephanie Tate. Coming up, trying to retain school teachers. If more pay isn't an option, how about a shorter school week? on Perspective after this. You're listening to Perspective. I'm Sherry Preston. Across the country, a lot of schools have been complaining about a shortage of teachers. Some school districts are offering bonuses to get more teachers in front of classrooms, but others are offering a shorter work week. Let's head to the state of Missouri, where a quarter of all districts in the state have changed their school week. Instead of 5 days, it's now just 4 days long. Here's ABC's Avery Harper.
Monday typically marks the start of a new week in most schools across the country. But classrooms in Warren County, Missouri are empty. No teachers, no students, no class. It's a part of the four-day school week the district adopted 4 years ago in an effort to attract and keep teachers in the classroom.
Take me back to 2019, when you all decided that you were going to go from 5 days of school per week to four. What drove that decision?
We're really a rural school district outside of higher paying districts. We struggled to retain our teaching staff. So we were losing about almost 20% of our teaching staff every year.
Warren County School Superintendent Greg Klingensmith says the shortened week is his best bargaining chip when recruiting teachers.
And we said, well, we can't pay, what can we bargain with? And time is what we had to bargain with. And that did work.
The practice is becoming more common. About 560 school districts in 25 states have one or more schools with a four-day week, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. In Missouri, schools with four-day schedules have lengthened the school day to meet the state's requirement for hours of instruction. The four-day week was a selling point for Casey and Gina Dildine. They're parents of three children and moved to teach in Warren County last year.
That kind of sealed it for me, just have the extra day to, you know, do things and get the stuff done we need to get done.
We have that Monday to take care of, you know, your family business that comes up. It's very helpful there with time with our babies and to just have that time, an extra day of, you know, spending time with them and watching them grow and develop. It's huge.
Look at the digital clock.
Gina Dildine teaches second grade and says the four-day week helps her avoid burnout.
Teaching is hard. It's exhausting. There's a whole lot of pressure and a whole lot of burden to teach these kids what they need to know, and that's our job. And so I feel like coming in on Tuesday after having that extra day to revive and refresh, that I'm more excited and more motivated to do my job.
While many teachers praise the shortened week, the effects of four-day weeks on student achievement aren't cut and dry, according to Emily Morton, who has been researching the topic.
I think there are a lot of parents who are a little apprehensive when they hear that their district is going 4 days because they think that it could affect outcomes for their students.
We do see, on average, we see some small to medium negative effects on student test scores. I think there needs to be continued monitoring of the effects of the policy and looking at, in each district, how it's affecting students' achievement.
Just outside of Kansas City, Independent School District, with its more than 14,000 students, is moving to 4 days next fall. Superintendent Dale Hurl says the number of applicants for teaching jobs in the district has shot up, and the number of resignations and retirements is down by more than half.
A year ago at this time, we had 86 resignations and retirements of teaching staff with 127 applications that we'd received. This year, we've only had 46 retirements and resignations, but 460 applications.
But not all parents in the district are convinced the change is a good idea.
We are a lower income area, and so I do have big concerns that some of our families are going to struggle.
Okay, so Greek yogurt, protein, or dairy.
Warren County parents who need childcare on the extra day off can opt to send their children to what the district has dubbed Care Day. Kids participate in a host of activities.
Do you think it's blended yet?
It's blended.
Like this nutrition class, where students are making smoothies. Or this station, where volunteers give kids haircuts. It's all free of charge for families.
They like coming home with all of their crafts and their little experiments that they do. So, yes, it's definitely been a positive.
In Independence, childcare will come at a cost for parents.
It is going to be an extra expense. It is going to be an extra worry to make sure that their kids are cared for. We are going to have some unsupervised kids.
Hurl says his district has worked to reduce care costs for younger students and has created new opportunities for high school students to make the most of the extra day.
A lot of students have said that they're excited about their ability to take college classes on those Mondays. So they're going to get a head start on going to college.
While the superintendents we spoke with say shortened school weeks have helped recruitment, both say teacher pay remains an obstacle to keeping teachers in the classroom.
Coming up, March Madness. What is America's fascination with college basketball's big tournament? On Perspective after this. You're listening to Perspective. I'm Sherry Preston.
Good if it goes! Furman has won! Furman has not been to the NCAA tournament in 43 years. And they pulled the first round upset.
Kevin Harlan with a call on True TV. The Division I college basketball tournaments are now underway, meaning we've now begun March Madness. 68 schools vie for the national title on both the men's and women's side every year. It's in full swing this weekend, and if you are anywhere near a TV, it's near impossible to avoid. Let's say for a minute, though, just for a minute, you're not a college basketball fan. You probably wonder every year what all the hoopla's about. To help us understand, we're going to turn to our partners at 538. Neil Payne is acting sports editor and senior writer there. Neil, what is America's fascination with this thing?
Well, you know, 40 million people will fill out brackets, so it's not an isolated fascination. I think it really has to do with, you know, live sports are one of the things that we can all kind of share as a common experience, and we're kind of running out of those in other sectors of the entertainment world or just generally life for the average person. So being able to kind of watch those things all at once and being able to talk to them with other people is valuable, I think, and people want to tap into that. There's also just the feeling of you don't know what's going to happen. It's sort of this unscripted drama that's unfolding in front of you in real time. And especially with college basketball, you know, it's called March Madness for a reason. You don't really know who's going to win. Even the big favorites, every year, one of the favorites will lose immediately. And of course, there's the gambling aspect of it, whether you put some money in for your office pool, and you're trying to see how you do. Maybe you're going for bragging rights against your fellow coworkers or your friends or your family. And nowadays, with the rise of, you know, sports betting becoming legalized and more prevalent, there's also that aspect where people have, you know, money on it that goes beyond just the bracket. So I think people have a lot of stake in it. Maybe they went to one of the schools that's in March Madness. That's another factor. Many people out there went to schools that are included in this. You know, there's 68 teams in the tournament field on the men's and then another 68 on the women's side. So, you know, there's all of these things that sort of tie into the emotional connection that you might have to a particular team or a player or just the game itself that makes it exciting for a lot of people, and they want to be able to share that experience together.
All right, so what's your prediction? But don't give me the standard, I think so-and-so is going to win. Tell me something fun.
Well, I one of the things that I bet there's an over-under for that you might be able to make a wager on, but there are always fun things around this montage that they show after the championship is won in a few weeks called One Shining Moment on CBS. It's this very cheesy, like, 80s song where it's talking about, you know, you're really striving and trying to achieve and everything, and then they show, you know, they invariably show, like, cheerleaders crying and players sort of, you know, celebrating and all of these things. So I think you could make like an over under on like, you know, three crying cheerleaders in the One Shining Moment montage. One Shining
Moment. Neil Payne, acting sports editor and senior writer at our partners at 538. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. The show was produced by Aaron Ferrer and Marwa Milwaukee. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you'd like to hear in the future and what you think. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia, Wednesday night at 10, 9 Central on ABC.